And you're listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. This is Shane Vanderhart. We're going to pick up this week with part two of an interview that Brian Myers had with John Christie. John Christie is a climatologist out of the University of Alabama, Huntsville. But before that, first, a word from our sponsors.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a better or the best life insurance plan for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
And we're back. And if you remember last time, Dr. Christie and Brian talked about consensus, the push for consensus as it deals with climate change. This episode, Dr. Christie deals with climate change as it applies to public policy. So without further ado, here's the interview.
And I read a while back where Bjorn Lomborg said that we will spend at least $100 trillion in order to reduce the temperature by the end of the century by a grand total of 0.3 degrees. This is a monumental exercise in futility with an extraordinarily high cost and a minuscule return on investment. Should illustrating this futility, in your opinion, be, is that the best way to combat climate change regulation?
It could be. The economic argument is always good to make, that if you tell people in very simple terms, your government is making you pay for something you get nothing in return for, and that's essentially what's happening here, that our country will be made poorer as a result of making energy prices greater, and we will be less competitive with the world, therefore we lose trade as a result. And it can be done. I did a similar case in federal court 10 years ago where I demonstrated this law will have no impact on the climate. And, in fact, James Hansen of NASA testified on the other side, and he could not contradict my result. My result was bulletproof. Yet, the judge who ruled in the case was, quite, you would say, liberal and green. He just overlooked facts and said, oh, it's okay to have this law, even though it has no impact on the climate. But it will raise prices for, in that case, for vehicles by quite a bit. So, rationality goes out the window when you're talking about a religion like climate change taking a hold of someone's life. And, a lot of these scientists and policymakers want that kind of greater good in their life to be done, and so they perceive their adventure into the climate change realm as a way to satisfy that kind of religious notion of helping save the planet.
So let me ask you this, as far as the satellite data is concerned, until RSS did their revisions, had the folks that were promoting
climate change legislation, had they been essentially either marginalizing your data set or ignoring it altogether?
Both. They marginalized it and ignored it. But they can't. I mean, when it comes down to science, they really can't, because the bulk atmospheric temperature, which is what the satellites take, it's the bulk of the atmosphere, that's where the greenhouse effect is supposed to show up first and the fastest. And it's not showing up like that at all. So if it gets into the courts, which I think it will soon, and cross-examination can be applied to all these assertions about climate change, you'll see that I hope that the evidence would prevail, and we get some of these laws overturned that are giving us problems in the economy.
I remember about a year and a half ago, the satellite data was ignored by NOAA when they did their study on the pause and released their findings just prior to the Paris summit. You remember that?
Yes.
And I remember hearing about the story on National Public Radio, and believe it or not, they referred to the satellite data as, quote, irrelevant, unquote.
Well, that's a religious assertion, because when it comes down to science, you have to get the satellite data right, because that's the bulk of the atmosphere. And if you can't get the bulk of the climate system right, what good is your model?
Couple more questions on the science, Dr. Christie. First of all, can you tell us what climate sensitivity is? And then also, can you speak to climate forcing? And then tell us why these things are important.
Okay, the climate sensitivity is just a handy number that says this is how much the temperature will change when the climate is forced by this extra amount of forcing. So climate forcing, you would say, is the amount of energy or the change in energy that's coming into the planet. So, for example, you might say, well, all the extra CO2 in the atmosphere is going to give a climate forcing of 2 watts per meter squared. So that's 2 more watts per meter squared of the roughly 235 that's coming in due to human greenhouse gases. But the sensitivity tells us, well, what's that going to do to the temperature of the planet? If you got 2 extra watts, what's it going to do? No one really knows what the climate sensitivity is. When we calculate it, it tells us the planet's not going to change much at all. When we use real data and calculate the sensitivity, then when you add these 2 extra watts, the climate isn't going to change much at all, because the climate system has a way to release that extra 2 watts per meter squared. So it's like it comes in one way and then flows out another way, and so the temperature of the planet doesn't change. The theory says, well, we're going to let this extra energy flow in, but we're not going to let it flow out, and therefore it stays in and heats up the planet. We don't see that in the real world, that most of the extra energy, that extra 2 watts that comes in, most of it just goes right back out to space, and therefore doesn't affect us at all. So the sensitivity, in a sense, tells us how much of that energy is retained in the system and how much goes out.
Every time I either read about this issue or I talk to an expert such as yourself, it just strikes me that this is such a highly complex type of an issue in which the popular thinking on it is it's simple enough to sort of just blame it on all sorts of human activity that produces carbon. And my gut reaction, although obviously I'm not a scientist, my gut reaction is something this complex with this many variables can't be chalked up to one single source. That's what strikes me anyway. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it is. To say humans cause some change, that's an easy answer. And not only is it easy, it's attractive, especially in the media, to say, oh, here is a problem and we caused it, cause and effect. When in fact there's no evidence for such a thing, and you certainly cannot prove such a thing, that a particular climate event or a particular heat wave or something was caused by humans. So you're right in that sense that the complexity is so great. I like to say in my Senate hearings and so on that our ignorance of the climate system is still enormous. And the real test of whether you understand the climate system well or not is make a prediction and see if it comes true. So that's the test. Well, we go back to the climate models. We look at their atmospheric temperature changes over the last 40 years, and they don't match reality. They are a terrible sort of prediction. And this is really doubly bad because they actually had the data to begin with and still couldn't match it. So the fact that we cannot predict what the atmosphere is doing tells us we do not understand the system, and our ignorance is still enormous.
Okay, one last subject I want to talk about, and that's maybe a little bit difficult for you to speak to. I'm not sure, Dr. Christie, but on April 22nd, Earth Day, there was a pretty scary event at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Can you tell us what happened?
The Sunday night, Monday morning after the Earth Day.
Aha, uh-huh. So it was March. It was Sunday morning, okay.
March for Science, I think it was. It was called a March for Science. Which, if you just looked out the window or talked to people, it was simply a march against Trump is all it was. It was a march against Trump. Anyway, after the march one night, something happened. We came to work Monday morning. There were bullet holes on the string of windows here at my office level. And this was a signal to us that people were upset with the research we do, and that this was a threat. Now, this was not the only threat we've had, but this was one with real bullets. And one of them landed about 10 feet away from where I sit, although it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. So this was a threat. And we were interviewed by the FBI and Homeland Security, who took it seriously because it was easy to connect the dots that this was a threatening response to the work we do here at UAH.
So the march took place on Sunday, and they estimate that the bullets were fired then sometime early Monday morning. Is that correct, or do I have that?
The march took place on Saturday.
March was on Saturday. Okay.
That Sunday night, Monday morning, that the shots were firing.
Okay. And from what you just said, I think you've concluded that this was indeed eco-terrorism.
Yes, and that's actually a federal statute, and that's why the FBI and Homeland Security were interviewing, and they have virtually no leads. They just have they know what type of weapon it was. It was kind of an exotic weapon. But no crime in North Alabama had ever been committed with that type of weapon, and so they don't have much of a thing to go on. And in Alabama, you really don't have much of a sense of a registration of firearms, so there's no real database to go back and look and find out who might have had that weapon.
So there's been no charges, no arrests, and really no leads. Have there been any changes made at the university as a result?
There are, yes. Patrols were increased, and also some extra cameras. The one camera that was looking this way, it was raining at the time, and all it could detect were that two cars had come next on the street. The shots were fired from a car. They both slowed down to almost a crawl, at which time the shots are fired, and then one sped off, and then the other one sped off. So it seems like there was a little bit of collusion involved in what was going on here.
Any further thoughts on this incident, other than the fact that it probably spooked you and your wife in a big time way?
Well, it probably spooked some of my staff more because they just didn't know that how can you, working for a scientist, be a dangerous occupation, you know? And you know, the other threats that come our way, I mean, probably one of the biggest one was when the Obama administration got their cronies in Congress to open an investigation on me and six other scientists. And they were just trying to intimidate us with these personal investigations of our finances and work and so on like that. It's a way that the administration was saying, these guys are on my hit list, so to speak.
And has that...
I would have to... What happened last April was more... has more of a history to it, I think, than just a couple of hotheads shooting up a window.
The investigation you mentioned a moment or two ago, has that concluded, that you got that behind you now?
The congressional one?
Yes.
Yes, the university, you know, went ahead and responded. Some universities, there were seven of us, under investigation. And one or two of the universities just said, no, we don't have to, cooperate with this investigation. It wasn't sanctioned by the full committee. Full committee would never have asked for an investigation. It was just this Democratic congressman who was working, through the Obama administration. And so after that, it was closed. And, of course, they never found anything because, they could not believe someone would have a view like mine without being paid under the table. That was the bottom line. And they looked all the way through me, and they couldn't find anywhere where I might have been being paid under the table, because I wasn't.
Yeah, that's something, as you know, we hear all the time about the so-called climate deniers or so-called climate skeptics, is that they're oil company shills and so on.
Right. I don't know anyone, in this field, in the science part of it, that has been paid by those guys. However, on the other side, on the environmental lobby side, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars goes to their pockets.
Yeah, and I do tend to think that it's becoming a bit more obvious that this is all about money. It's all about research funding and things like that. I heard a piece on National Public Radio just today in which they were talking about Sam Clovis, who's apparently been named as the chief scientist for the FDA, and the big problem that the left apparently has with Sam Clovis in this position is specifically his views on climate change, and the concern is that the U.S. I said FDA, forgive me, it's USDA, the USDA. With Clovis at its head, may not fund all the climate research, and so they're panicked about that.
Yeah, they shouldn't either.
Say again?
USDA shouldn't be going into that climate change stuff. They should be looking at the weather variables that affect the climate the most, that affect farmers the most. What is that interannual variability that just hits them so hard? How can we make our agricultural system more resilient to those factors that we know are going to occur? Because all these predictions about climate change just have been falsified. In fact, there's one Iowa farmer who stood up recently at one of these climate change conferences and said, if I had believed you 20 years ago and followed your instructions to plan according to your views of climate change, I'd be out of business by now.
Yeah, he'd lost his farm a long time ago.
Yeah, but it turns out our harvests are growing. They're not declining. We're clever people. We know how to handle a lot. And so USDA, I don't think should be in that climate change business very much at all.
Well, Dr. Christie, I really appreciate you taking the time to let me interview you. I have learned a lot, as I always do whenever I speak to you guys, and I trust we'll have an opportunity to speak again. I told Roy Spencer last year I was going to try to get down your way and maybe get together with you guys sometime. I would like very much to do that, maybe spend a little time with you in person and do another interview.
Okay.
Well, thanks again for your time, and I hope we stay in touch, sir.
Okay, well, thank you.
Every blessing. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hey, this is Shane Vanderhart again. I hope you found this interview informative. Be sure to catch part one. Also, if you're not listening to this podcast on CaffeinatedThoughts.com and using some third-party app instead like iTunes or Google Play, be sure to go to CaffeinatedThoughts.com and check out all our daily updates. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails. We'd love to have you stay in touch with us. Until next time, my friends, take care.